Without a plan, Eddie jogged along Central Park South in what had become a downpour. He wished vaguely, as he approached first the St. Moritz and then the plaza, that he would discover a string of taxis waiting for the hotel guests at the curb. What he found instead were two lines of determined hotel guests waiting for taxis. Eddie darted into the plaza and presented himself at the registration desk where he asked for change, lots of change, for a $10 bill. He could take a bus up Madison Avenue if he had the exact fare. But before he could mumble what he wanted, the woman at the registration desk asked him if he was a guest at the hotel. Sometimes, spontaneously, Eddie was capable of lying, but almost never when he wanted to. "No, I'm not a guest. I just need bus money," he admitted. The woman shook her head. "I'd get in trouble if you're not a guest," she said. He had to run up Fifth Avenue before he could cross at 62nd. Then he ran up Madison until he found a coffee shop where he could buy a Diet Coke, solely because he wanted some change. He left the Diet Coke at the cash register, together with a tip of disproportionate generosity, but the woman at the cash register judged the tip to be insufficient. The way she saw it, Eddie had left her with a Diet Coke to dispose of, a task unworthy of her. Or insurmountable, or both. "Like I need this trouble," she shouted after him. Eddie waited in the rain for the Madison Avenue bus. He was already soaked and 5 minutes late. It was now 7:35. The event began at 8. The organizers of Ruth Cole's reading at the Y had wanted Eddie and Ruth to meet backstage, to have a little time to relax, to get to know each other. No one, least of all Eddie or Ruth, had said, "To get reacquainted." How does one get reacquainted with a 4-year-old when she's 36? Eddie had briefly wondered. The other people waiting for the bus knew enough to step back from the curb, but Eddie stood where he was. The bus, which he thought would stop, did not stop. It splashed the water from the flooded gutter onto Eddie's chest and midsection. Now he was not only wet, he was filthy, and a part of the dirty puddle was sloshing in the bottom of his briefcase. He had inscribed a copy of 60 Times for Ruth, although it had been published 3 years ago, and if Ruth had been inclined to read it, she would already have done so. Eddie had often imagined Ted Cole's remarks to his daughter on the subject of 60 Times. "Wishful thinking," Ted would have said, or, "Sheer exaggeration, your mother hardly knew the guy." What Ted had actually said to Ruth is more interesting and totally true of Eddie. What Ted had told his daughter was, "This poor kid never got over fucking your mother." "He's not a kid anymore, Daddy," Ruth had replied. "If I'm in my 30s, Eddie O'Hare's in his 40s, right?" "He's still a kid, Ruthie," Ted had told her. "Eddie will always be a kid." Indeed, as he struggled onto the Madison Avenue bus, Eddie's accumulated distress and anxiety made him resemble a 48-year-old adolescent. The driver was angry with him for not knowing what the exact fare was, and although Eddie had a bulging fistful of change in his pocket, his pants were so wet that he could retrieve the coins only one at a time. The people standing behind him, most of them still in the rain, were angry with Eddie too. Then, in attempting to empty his briefcase of the water from the gutter, Eddie poured a brownish puddle on the shoe of an elderly man who did not speak English. Eddie could not understand the language the man spoke to him, and he didn't even know which language it was. It was also hard to hear on the bus, and impossible to make up the driver's occasional utterances, the names of the cross streets, the stops, or the potential stops they were passing. The reason Eddie couldn't hear was that a young black man sat in an aisle seat of the bus with a large portable radio and cassette player in his lap. A loud, lewd song throbbed throughout the bus, the only discernible lyrics being a repeated phrase. It was something like, "You wouldn't know the truth, mon, if she sat on your face."
"Excuse me," Eddie said to the young man, "would you mind turning that down a little? I can't hear what the driver is saying."
The young man smiled charmingly and said,
"I can't hear what you say, man, 'cause the box is too fucking loud."
Some of the surrounding passengers, whether out of nervousness or genuine appreciation, laughed. Eddie leaned over a matronly black woman in a nearby seat. He rubbed the fogged-up window with the heel of his hand. Possibly he could see the upcoming cross streets. But his bulky brown briefcase slipped off his shoulder. The shoulder strap was as wet as Eddie's clothes, and the briefcase struck the woman in her face. The wet briefcase knocked the woman's glasses off. She was fortunate to catch them in her lap, but she caught them too hard. She popped one of the lenses out of the frame. She looked blindly up at Eddie with a lunacy born of many disappointments and sorrows. "What you want to be making trouble for me for?" she asked. The throbbing song about the truth sitting on someone's face instantly stopped. The young black man seated across the aisle stood up, the silent boombox hugged to his chest like a boulder. "That my mom," the boy said. He was short. The top of his head came only to the knot in Eddie's tie. But the boy's neck was as big around as Eddie's thigh, and the boy's shoulders were twice as broad and thick as Eddie's. "Why you making trouble for my mom?" the powerful-looking young man asked. Since Eddie had left the New York Athletic Club, it was the fourth mention of trouble that he had heard. It was why he'd never wanted to live in New York. "I was just trying to see my stop, where I get out," Eddie said. "Dis here your stop," the brutish boy told him, yanking the cord. The bus braked, throwing Eddie off balance. Again, his heavy briefcase slipped off his shoulder. This time, it hit no one because Eddie clutched it in both his hands. "Dis here where you get out," the squat young man said. His mother and several surrounding passengers agreed. "Oh, well," Eddie thought as he got off the bus. Maybe it was almost 92nd Street. It was 81st. He heard someone say good riddance just before the bus moved on. Minutes later, Eddie ran along 89th Street, crossing to the east side of Park Avenue, where he spotted an available taxi. Without thinking that he was now only three uptown blocks and one crosstown block from his destination, Eddie hailed the cab. He got into the taxi and told the cabbie where to go. 92nd and Lex," the taxi driver said. "Christ, you should have walked. You're already wet." "But I'm late," Eddie lamely replied. "Everyone's late," the cabbie told him. The fare was so small, Eddie tried to compensate the taxi driver by giving him his entire ball of change. "It's $10 less one Diet Coke, less a tip, less one bus fare," Eddie explained, holding in both palms the pile of wet coins. It had taken him the entire short ride to extricate the change from his pants pocket. "Christ!" the cabbie shouted. "What do I want with all that?" At least he didn't say trouble, Eddie thought, stuffing the coins into his jacket pocket. All the bills in Eddie's wallet were wet. The taxi driver disapproved of them, too. "You're worse than late and wet," the driver told Eddie. "You're fucking trouble." "Thank you," Eddie said. In one of his more philosophical moments, Minty O'Hare had told his son to never look down his nose at a compliment. There might not be all that many. Thus did a muddied and dripping Eddie O'Hare present himself to a young woman taking tickets in the crowded lobby of the 92nd Street Y. "I'm here for the reading. I know I'm a little late," Eddie began. "Where's your ticket?" the girl asked him. "We're sold out. We've been sold out for weeks." Sold out? Eddie had rarely seen a sellout crowd at the Kauffman Concert Hall. He'd heard several famous authors read there. He'd even introduced a couple of them. When Eddie had given a reading in the concert hall, of course he had never read alone. Only well-known writers like Ruth Cole read alone. The last time Eddie had read there, it had been billed as an evening of novels of manners. Or maybe it was an evening of comic novels of manners. Or comic manners? All Eddie could remember was that the other two novelists who read with him had been funnier than he had been. Eddie said to the girl taking tickets, "I don't need a ticket because I'm the introducer." He was fishing through his drenched briefcase for the copy of 60 Times, which he'd inscribed to Ruth. He wanted to show the girl his jacket photo to prove he was really who he said he was. "You're the what?" the girl said. Then she saw the sodden book that he held out to her. 60 Times, a novel, Ed O'Hare. It was only on his books that Eddie finally got to be called Ed. His father still called him Edward, and everyone else called him Eddie. Even in his not-so-good reviews, Eddie was pleased when he was referred to as just plain Ed O'Hare. "I'm the introducer," Eddie repeated to the girl taking tickets. "I'm Ed O'Hare." "Oh, my God," the girl cried. "You're Eddie O'Hare. They've been waiting and waiting for you. You're very late." "I'm sorry," he began, but the girl was already pulling him through the crowd. Sold out, Eddie was thinking. What a mob it was. And how young they were. Most of them looked as if they were still in college. It wasn't the typical audience at the Y, although Eddie began to see that the usual people were also there. In Eddie's estimation, the usual people were a grave-looking literary crowd, frowning in advance of what they were about to hear. It was not Eddie O'Hare's kind of audience. Absent were those fragile-looking older women who were always alone, or with a deeply troubled woman friend, and those traumatized, self-conscious younger men who always struck Eddie as too pretty in an unmanly sort of way. It was the way Eddie saw himself, too pretty in an unmanly sort of way. "Jesus God, what am I doing here?" Eddie thought. Why had he agreed to introduce Ruth Cole? Why had they asked him? He wondered desperately. Had it been Ruth's idea? The backstage of the concert hall was so muggy that Eddie couldn't tell the difference between his sweat and the rain damage to his clothes, not to mention the remains of the giant mud puddle. "There's a washroom just off the green room," the girl was saying, "in case you want to, clean up." "I'm a mess, and I have nothing interesting to say," Eddie concluded. For years he had imagined meeting Ruth again. But he had pictured a meeting vastly different from this, something more private, maybe lunch or dinner. And Ruth must have at least occasionally imagined meeting him. After all, Ted would have had to tell his daughter about her mother and the circumstances of that summer of 58. Ted could never have restrained himself. Naturally, Eddie would have been a part of the story, if not the principal villain. And wasn't it fair to anticipate that Eddie and Ruth would have much to talk about, even if their chief interest in common was Marion? After all, they both wrote novels. Albeit their novels were worlds apart, Ruth was a superstar and Eddie was... God, what am I? Eddie considered. Compared to Ruth Cole, I'm a nobody, Eddie concluded. Maybe that was the way to begin his introduction. Yet when he'd been invited to introduce her, Eddie fervently believed he had the best of all reasons to accept the invitation. For 8 years, he'd harbored a secret that he wanted to share with Ruth. For 8 years, he'd kept the evidence to himself. Now, on this miserable night, he'd carried the evidence with him in his bulky brown briefcase. What did it matter that the evidence had gotten a little wet? In his briefcase, there was a second book, of much more importance to Ruth, Eddie believed, than his personally inscribed copy of 60 Times. 8 years ago, when Eddie had first read this other book, he'd been tempted to tell Ruth then. He'd even considered bringing the book to Ruth's attention by some anonymous means. But then he'd read an interview with Ruth, and something she'd said in it had prevented Eddie from pressing the matter. It had been one of those personal questions which Ruth always refused to take seriously. She never talked in depth about her father, or whether or not she ever intended to write a book for children. When interviewers asked if her father had taught her to write, she said, "He taught me something about storytelling and squash. But about writing, no. He taught me nothing about writing, really." And when they would ask her about her mother, if her mother was still missing, or if being abandoned as a child had had any great effect on her, either as a writer or as a woman, Ruth would seem fairly indifferent to the question. "Yes, you might say that my mother is still missing, although I'm not looking for her. If she were looking for me, she would have found me. Since she's the one who left, I would never press myself on her. If she wants to find me, I'm the one who's easy to find," Ruth had said. And in the particular interview that had stopped Eddie from making contact with Ruth 8 years ago,
The interviewer had pursued a personal interpretation of Ruth Cole's novels. But in your books, in all your books, there are no mothers. There are no fathers either, Ruth had replied. Yes, but, the interviewer had gone on, your women characters have women friends and they have boyfriends, you know, lovers, but they are women characters who have no relationship with their mothers. We rarely even meet their mothers. Don't you think that's, unusual? The interviewer had asked. Not if you don't have a mother, Ruth had answered. Ruth didn't want to know about her mother, Eddie had surmised. And so he had kept his evidence to himself. But then, when he'd received the invitation to introduce Ruth Cole at the 92nd Street Y, Eddie had decided that, of course, Ruth wanted to know about her mother. And so he'd agreed to introduce her. And in his soggy briefcase, he now carried this mysterious book which 8 years ago he had come close to forcing on Ruth. Eddie O'Hare was convinced that the book had been written by Marion. It was already past 8 o'clock. Like a large, restless animal in a cage, the enormous audience in the concert hall made their impatient presence felt, although Eddie could no longer see them. The girl led him by his wet arm through a dark, mildewy hall, up a spiral staircase, past the towering curtains behind the dim stage. There Eddie saw a stagehand seated on a stool. The sinister-looking young man was transfixed by the TV monitor. The camera was trained on the podium on the stage. Eddie singled out the waiting water glass and the microphone. He made a mental note not to drink from the water glass. The water was for Ruth, not for her lowly introducer. Then Eddie was shoved into the green room, which was overbright with dazzling mirrors and the glare of makeup lights. Eddie had long rehearsed what he would say to Ruth when they met. "My goodness, how you've grown!" For a comic novelist, he was bad at jokes. Nevertheless, the line was on his lips. He freed his soaking right hand from the shoulder strap of his briefcase, but the woman who stepped forward to greet him was not Ruth, nor did she shake Eddie's outstretched hand. It was that awfully nice woman who was one of the organizers at the Y. Eddie had met her several times. She was always friendly and sincere, and she did her best to put Eddie at ease, which was impossible. Melissa, that was her name. She kissed Eddie's wet cheek and said to him, "We were so worried about you." Eddie said, "My goodness, how you've grown." Melissa, who had not grown, she was not pregnant at the time either, was somewhat taken aback. But Melissa was such a nice person that she seemed more concerned for Eddie's well-being than she appeared to be offended, although Eddie felt ready to burst into tears on Melissa's behalf. Then someone shook Eddie's outstretched hand. It was too large and vigorous a handshake to have been Ruth's, and so Eddie managed to restrain himself from saying, "My goodness, how you've grown," again. It was Carl, another of the good people who directed the activities at the Poetry Center. Carl was a poet. He was also smart and as tall as Eddie, and he'd always been immensely kind to Eddie. It was Carl who was kind enough to include Eddie in many events at the 92nd Street Y, even those that Eddie felt unworthy of, like this one. "It's raining," Eddie told Carl. There must have been a half dozen people crammed into the green room. At Eddie's remark, they roared with laughter. This was vintage deadpan humor of the kind they would expect to encounter in a novel by Ed O'Hare. But Eddie simply hadn't known what else to say. He just went on shaking hands, shedding water like a wet dog. That very important person at Random House, Ruth's editor, was there. The editor of Ruth's first two novels, a woman, had died recently, and now this man had succeeded her. Eddie had met him 3 or 4 times, but could never recall his name. Whatever his name was, he never remembered that he'd met Eddie before. Not once had Eddie taken it personally. Until now. The walls of the green room were star-studded with photographs of the world's most important authors. Eddie was surrounded by writers of international stature and renown.
He recognized Ruth's photograph before he noticed Ruth. Her picture was not out of place on a wall with several Nobel Prize winners. It would never have occurred to Eddie to look for his own photograph there. Indeed, he would not have found it. It was her new editor who literally pushed Ruth forward to meet Eddie. The man from Random House had a hearty, aggressive air, an avuncular style. He placed a large, familiar hand squarely between Ruth's shoulders and shoved her out of the corner of the room where she appeared to have been holding herself back. Ruth was not shy. Eddie knew this about her from her many interviews. But seeing her in person, for the first time as an adult, Eddie realized that there was something deliberately small about Ruth Cole. It was as if she had willed herself to be small. In fact, she was no shorter than the thug on the Madison Avenue bus. Although Ruth was her father's height, which was not notably short for a woman, she wasn't as tall as Marion. Yet her smallness was distinct from her height. Like Ted, she was athletically compact. She was wearing her signature black T-shirt, in which Eddie could instantly discern the greater muscular development in Ruth's right arm. Both the forearm and biceps of her right arm were noticeably bigger and stronger than their counterparts on her thin left arm. Squash, like tennis, did that to you. Eddie took one look at her and assumed that she could beat the shit out of Ted. Indeed, on any squash court of regulation size, she could have. Eddie could never have imagined how badly Ruth wanted to beat the shit out of her father. Nor could Eddie have guessed that the old man still got the better of his hard-looking daughter in his barn of unfair advantages. "Hello, Ruth. I've been looking forward to seeing you," Eddie said. "Hello. Again," Ruth said, shaking his hand. She had her father's short, square fingers. "Oh," said the Random House editor, "I didn't know you two had met." Ruth had her father's wry smile, too. Her smile arrested Eddie's speech. "Do you want to use the bathroom first?" she asked Eddie. And there again came the avuncular editor's large hand, this time a little too familiarly between Eddie's shoulders. "Yes, yes, let's allow Mr. O'Hare a minute for some hasty repairs," Ruth's new editor said. It was not until he was alone in the bathroom that Eddie realized the degree to which repairs were in order. He was not just wet and dirty. A cellophane package, like something from a pack of cigarettes, clung to his tie. A gum wrapper, which upon closer inspection revealed a well-chewed piece of gum, had adhered to his fly. His shirt was soaked through. In the mirror, Eddie at first failed to recognize his nipples. He tried to brush them off, as if they were more chewing gum. He decided that his best recourse was to remove his jacket and his shirt and wring them out in his hands. He wrung the excess water from his tie, too. But when he redressed himself, he saw that he'd created the most extraordinary wrinkles in both his tie and in his shirt, and that his shirt, which was formerly dress white, was now a streaked and faded pink. He looked at his hands, which were stained from the familiar red ink of his correcting pen, his so-called teacher's favorite, and, even before he peered in his briefcase, he knew that the revisions in red on the manuscript of his speech would have first run red and then turned to pink on the wet pages. When he looked at his introductory speech, he saw that all his handwritten revisions were erased or blurred beyond recognition, and that the original typescript, which was now offset against a pink background, was notably less clear than it had been. After all, it had once stood out against a clean white page. The heavy ball of coins pulled his jacket askew. Eddie could find no wastebasket in the bathroom. At what he hoped was the height of his ill-advised behavior for the day, he dumped all his change into the toilet. After he flushed and the water cleared, he saw with his usual resignation that all the quarters had remained in the bottom of the toilet bowl. Ruth used the bathroom after Eddie. When he was following her backstage, while most of the others found their way into the audience and to their seats, she looked over her shoulder and said to him, "An odd place for a wishing well, wasn't it?" It took him a second or two to realize that she was referring to the coins in the toilet bowl. He couldn't tell, of course, if she knew it was his money. Then, more straightforwardly, without mischief, she said, "We'll have dinner after this, I hope. A chance to talk." Eddie's heart jumped. Had she meant that they would have dinner alone? Even Eddie knew better than to hope so. She'd meant with Carl and with Melissa, and doubtless with her avuncular new editor from Random House, not to mention with his large, too familiar hands. Yet maybe Eddie could steal a moment alone with her. If not, he might be able to suggest a later, more private meeting. He was smiling idiotically, transfixed as he was by her handsome, some would say pretty, face. Ruth's thin upper lip was Marion's upper lip. Her full breasts, which were slightly pendulous, were her mother's too. However, without Marion's long waist, Ruth's breasts appeared too big for the rest of her. And she had her father's short, sturdy legs. Ruth's black T-shirt was an expensive one. It fit her very nicely. It was made of some silky material, something finer than cotton, Eddie supposed. Her jeans were something better than jeans, too. They were also black. They also fit her nicely. And Eddie had seen her give her jacket to her editor. It was a tailored black cashmere jacket that dressed up the T-shirt and the jeans. For her reading, Ruth hadn't wanted the jacket. Her fans expected the T-shirt, Eddie concluded. And she was definitely a writer with more than mere readers. Ruth Cole had fans. Eddie was frankly frightened to be speaking to them. When Eddie noticed that Carl was at that moment engaged in introducing him, he chose not to listen. The sinister-looking stagehand had offered Ruth his stool, but she chose to stand, shifting her weight from foot to foot, as if she were about to play squash, not give a reading. "My speech," Eddie began to say to Ruth, "I'm not very pleased with it. All the ink ran." She put one of her short, square index fingers to her lips. When he stopped talking, she leaned forward and whispered in his ear, "Thank you for not writing about me," she whispered. "I know you could have." Eddie couldn't speak until he heard her whisper. He'd not realized that Ruth had her mother's voice. Then Ruth was pushing him toward the stage. Since he hadn't been listening to Carl's introduction, Eddie didn't know that Carl and the audience, which was Ruth Cole's audience, were waiting for him. Ruth had been waiting her whole life to meet Eddie O'Hare. From the first time she'd been told about Eddie and her mother, Ruth had wanted to meet him. Now she couldn't bear to watch him walk out on the stage because he was walking away from her. Instead, she watched him on the TV monitor. From the camera's perspective, which was the view from the audience, Eddie wasn't walking away, he was walking toward the audience. He was facing the audience and the crowd. "He is coming to meet me at last," Ruth was imagining. But what on earth could my mother have ever seen in him? Ruth wondered. What a pathetic, unfortunate man. On the small screen of the TV monitor, she studied Eddie in black and white. The primitive image made Eddie appear youthful. She could see what a beautiful boy he must have been. But in a man, prettiness had only a temporary appeal. As Eddie O'Hare began to speak about her and her writing, Ruth distracted herself with a familiar and troublesome question. What permanently appeal to her in a man? Ruth at 36. A man should be confident, Ruth thought. After all, men were designed to be aggressive. Yet her attraction to confident, aggressive men had led her into some questionable relationships. She would never tolerate physical aggression. So far, she'd been spared any violent episodes, some of which had befallen her friends. Ruth held her friends at least partially responsible for these abusive relationships. Given how little she liked or trusted her instincts with men, Ruth surprisingly believed that she could detect a man's capacity for violence against women on the very first date. In the confounding world of sex, it was one of the few things Ruth was proud of about herself. Although Hannah Grant, who was Ruth's best friend, had repeatedly told Ruth that she'd simply been lucky. "You just haven't met the right guy. I mean, the wrong guy," Hannah had told her. "You just haven't had that date." "A man should respect my independence," Ruth believed. She never concealed the fact that she was uncertain about marriage, and more uncertain about motherhood. Yet those men who acknowledged her so-called independence often exhibited the most unacceptable form of lack of commitment. Ruth wouldn't tolerate infidelity. Indeed, she demanded faithfulness from even the newest boyfriend. Was she merely old-fashioned? Hannah had often ridiculed Ruth for what Hannah called contradictory behavior. At 36, Ruth had never lived with a man. Yet Ruth expected any boyfriend of the moment to be faithful to her while not living with her. "I fail to see anything contradictory in that," Ruth had told Hannah. But Hannah presumed a superiority to Ruth in matters of male-female relationships. On the basis of having had more of them, Ruth supposed. By Ruth's standards, even by more liberal sexual standards than Ruth's, Hannah Grant was promiscuous. At the moment, as Ruth waited to read from her new novel at the 92nd Street Y, Hannah was also late. Ruth had expected Hannah to meet her in the green room before the event. Now Ruth worried that Hannah would arrive too late to be admitted, although a seat had been reserved for her. It was just like Hannah. She'd probably met a guy and got to talking. Hannah would have got to more than talking. Returning her attention to the small black-and-white screen of the TV monitor, Ruth tried to concentrate on what Eddie O'Hare was saying. She had been introduced on many occasions, but never by her mother's former lover. While this certainly distinguished Eddie, there was nothing distinguished about Eddie's introduction. 10 years ago, Eddie had begun, and Ruth lowered her chin to her chest. This time, when the young stagehand offered her his stool, she accepted. If Eddie was going to begin at the beginning, Ruth knew she had better sit down. "Published in 1980, when she was only 26, Eddie intoned, "Ruth Cole's first novel, The Same Orphanage, was set in a rural New England village that was renowned for its history of supporting alternative lifestyles. A socialist and a lesbian commune had both prospered there, but they eventually disbanded. A college of questionable admissions standards had briefly flourished. It existed solely to provide a 4-year student deferment for those young men seeking not to be drafted into the war in Vietnam. When the war was over, the college folded. And throughout the 60s and the early 70s, prior to the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, which legalized abortion in 1973, the village also supported a small orphanage. In those years, when the procedure was still illegal, it was well known, at least locally, that the orphanage physician would provide abortions." Here Eddie paused. The house lights were so low that he couldn't see a single face in the vast audience. Without thinking, he took a sip from Ruth's water glass. In fact, Ruth had graduated from Exeter in the same year as the Roe v. Wade decision. In her novel, two Exeter girls get pregnant. They are expelled from school without ever identifying the would-be father. It turns out that they had the same boyfriend. The 26-year-old author once joked in an interview that the working title for the same orphanage was The Same Boyfriend. Eddie O'Hare, who was doomed to be only autobiographical in his novels, knew better than to presume that Ruth Cole was writing about herself. He understood from the first time he read her that she was better than that. But in several interviews, Ruth had admitted to having a close friendship at Exeter with a girl with whom she'd shared a crush on the same boy. Eddie didn't know that Ruth's roommate and best friend at Exeter had been Hannah Grant, nor did he know that Hannah was expected to attend Ruth's reading. Hannah had heard Ruth read before, many times. What made this reading special to her and to Ruth was that the two friends had spent much of their time together talking about Eddie O'Hare. Hannah had been dying to meet Eddie. As for the two friends having once had a crush on the same boy at Exeter, Eddie couldn't have known, but he guessed correctly, that Ruth had never had sex at Exeter. In fact, and this was no easy accomplishment in the 70s, Ruth managed to get through her college years without having had sex either. Hannah, of course, hadn't waited. She'd had sex several times at Exeter, and her first abortion before she graduated. In Ruth's novel, the expelled Exeter girls with a boyfriend in common are taken by one of the girls' parents to the same orphanage of the title. One of these young women has her baby delivered in the orphanage, but she elects to keep the baby. She can't bear to let it be adopted. The other young woman has an illegal abortion. The Exeter boy, twice a would-be father, and now graduated from the academy, marries the girl with the baby. The young couple make an effort to stay married for the sake of the child, but the marriage fails, after a mere 18 years. The girl who chose the abortion, now an unmarried woman in her late 30s, is reunited with her ex-boyfriend. She marries him. Throughout the novel, the friendship between the Exeter women is tested. The abortion or adoption decision and the changing moral climate of the times will haunt them as they grow older. While Ruth portrays both women sympathetically, her personal abortion politics, she supported the pro-choice position, were heralded by feminists. And notwithstanding that it was a didactic novel, The Same Orphanage was critically acclaimed in more than 25 languages. It had its dissenters, too, that the novel concludes with the bitter dissolution of the two women's friendship did not make every feminist happy. That the woman who chooses to have the abortion is unable to get pregnant with her ex-boyfriend was denounced by some pro-choice feminists as anti-abortion mythology. Although Ruth never implies that the woman can't get pregnant because of her previous abortion. Maybe she can't get pregnant because she's 38, Ruth said in an interview, which was denounced by several women who said they were speaking on behalf of all those women over 40 who are able to get pregnant. It was that kind of novel. It wasn't going to escape scot-free. The divorced woman in the same orphanage, the one who has the baby soon after she's expelled from Exeter, offers to have another baby and give it to her friend. She'll be a surrogate mom with her ex-husband's sperm. But the woman who can't conceive declines the offer. She settles for childlessness instead. In the novel, the motivation of the ex-wife to play the role of surrogate mom is suspect. Yet, unsurprisingly, some surrogate mothers attacked the book for misrepresenting them. Ruth Cole, even at 26, never went to great lengths to defend herself from her critics. "Look, it's a novel," she said. "They're my characters. They do what I want them to do." She was similarly dismissive of the most common description of the same orphanage, namely, that it was about abortion. "It's a novel," Ruth repeated. "It's not about anything. It's a good story. It's a demonstration of how the choices two women make will affect the rest of their lives. The choices we make do affect us, don't they?" and Ruth distanced herself from not a few of her more avid readers by admitting that she'd never had an abortion. It was insulting to some of her readers who'd had abortions that Ruth had just imagined having one. "I'm certainly not opposed to having an abortion or to anyone else having one," Ruth said. "In my case, it just never came up." Ruth had always known that an abortion came up on two more occasions for Hannah Grant. They had applied to the same colleges, only the best ones. When Hannah didn't get into most of them, they'd attended Middlebury. What mattered to both of them, or so they said, was staying together, even if it meant spending 4 years in Vermont. In retrospect, Ruth wondered why staying together had mattered to Hannah, who had spent most of her time at Middlebury with a hockey player with a removable false tooth. He got her pregnant twice, and when they broke up, he tried to date Ruth. It had prompted Ruth's now notorious remark to Hannah on the subject of rules for relationships. "What rules?" Hannah had asked. "There are no rules among friends, surely." "Rules among friends are especially necessary," Ruth had told her friend. "For example, I don't go out with anyone who ever went out with you, or who asked you first."
"And vice versa?" Hannah had asked.
"Well..." It was a habit Ruth had picked up from her father. "That's your choice," she'd told Hannah, who had never tested the rule, at least not that Ruth knew. For Ruth's part, she'd stuck to her own rule, absolutely. And now Hannah was late. While Ruth tried to watch the TV monitor, where Eddie O'Hare was struggling on and on, she was aware that the sneaky-looking stagehand was watching her. He was the kind of guy Hannah would have called cute. Doubtless, Hannah would have flirted with him, but Ruth rarely flirted. Besides, he was not her type, if she had a type. She did have a type, and the type bothered her about herself more than she could say. Ruth looked at her watch. Eddie was still talking about her first novel. "With two more novels to go, we'll be here all night," Ruth was thinking, as she again watched Eddie drink her water. "And if he's got a cold, I'll catch it," she thought to herself. Ruth considered trying to get Eddie's attention. Instead, she looked up at the stagehand, who had been staring nonstop at her breasts. If Ruth had to pick one thing that most men were utterly stupid about, it was that they didn't seem to know that it was obvious to a woman when a man was staring at her breasts. "I wouldn't say that was my pet peeve with men," Hannah had told Ruth. Hannah's breasts were rather small, at least this was Hannah's estimation. "With boobs like yours, what else are men going to stare at?" Hannah had asked Ruth. Yet whenever Ruth and Hannah were together, men generally looked at Hannah first. She was tall and blonde. She had a slinky figure. She was sexier than Ruth, Ruth thought. "It's just my clothes. My clothes are sexier," Hannah had told her. "If you try dressing like a woman, men might notice you more." "It's enough that they notice my boobs," Ruth had replied. Maybe they'd managed so well as roommates and had on numerous occasions traveled together, which is even harder than being roommates, because they wouldn't, indeed they couldn't, wear the same clothes. It was not because she had grown up without a mother that Ruth Cole preferred to wear men's clothes. As a child, she'd been dressed in an exceedingly girlish fashion by Conchita Gomez, who had sent Ruth off to Exeter with a closet full of little girls' skirts and dresses, which Ruth hated. She liked jeans, or pants that fit her as snugly as jeans. She liked T-shirts, and boys' or men's dress shirts, not turtlenecks, because she was short and had no neck to begin with, and not sweaters, which were too bulky and made her look fat. She was not fat, and she only seemed short. It was mainly because her torso was so truncated that her breasts appeared to be too big for her body. Ruth had tested the dress code at Exeter by conforming to the dress code for boys. Since then, it had become her style. Now, of course, her jackets, even if they were men's jackets, were tailored to fit her figure. For black tie occasions, Ruth wore a woman's tuxedo, which was tailored to her figure, too. She did own the so-called standard little black dress, but Ruth never, except on the hottest summer days, wore a dress. Her most frequent substitute for a dress was a navy blue pinstriped pantsuit, which she preferred for cocktail parties and fancy restaurants. It was her uniform for funerals, too. Ruth spent a fair amount of money on clothes, but they were always the same clothes. She spent more money on shoes, because she liked a low, sturdy heel, something that made her ankles feel almost as secure as she felt in her squash shoes. Her shoes tended to have a sameness about them, too. Ruth let Hannah tell her where to get her hair cut, but she wouldn't listen to Hannah's advice that she should grow her hair longer. And aside from lip gloss and a certain kind of colorless lipstick, Ruth didn't wear makeup. A good moisturizer, the right shampoo, and the right deodorant, these would do. She let Hannah buy her underwear, too. "Jesus, it kills me to buy you your goddamn 34D, Hannah would complain. "Both of my boobs could fit in one of your fucking cups." Ruth thought that she was too old to consider breast reduction surgery. But as a teenager, she'd begged her father to allow her to have the operation. Not just the size, but the weight of her breasts had bothered her. Ruth despaired that her nipples and the surrounding areole were too low and too large. Her father would hear none of it. He said it was nonsense to mutilate her God-given good figure. Breasts could never be too large for Ted Cole. "Oh, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy," Ruth thought angrily, as the gaze of the single-minded stagehand remained riveted to her breasts. She sensed that Eddie O'Hare overpraised her. He said something about her well-publicized claim that she did not write autobiographical fiction. But Eddie was still mired in Ruth Cole's first novel. This was the longest introduction in the world. By the time it was her turn, the audience would be fast asleep. Hannah Grant had told Ruth that she should get off her high horse about not writing autobiographical fiction. "For Christ's sake, aren't I autobiographical?" Hannah had asked her. "You always write about me." "I may borrow from your experiences, Hannah," Ruth had replied. "After all, you've had many more experiences than I've had, but I assure you I do not write about you. I make up my characters and their stories." "You make me up again and again," Hannah had argued. "It may be your version of me, but it's me, always me. You're more autobiographical than you think you are, baby." Ruth hated Hannah's usage of baby. Hannah was a journalist. She presumed that all novels were substantially autobiographical. Ruth was the novelist. She looked at her books and saw what she had invented. Hannah looked at them and saw what was real, namely, variations of Hannah herself. The truth, of course, lay somewhere in between. In Ruth's novels, there was usually a woman character who was an adventurer, the Hannah character, Hannah called her. And there was always another woman character who held herself back, the less bold character, Ruth called her. The Ruth character, Hannah said. Ruth both admired and was appalled by Hannah's boldness. For her part, Hannah both looked up to Ruth and constantly criticized her. Hannah respected Ruth's success, while at the same time she reduced Ruth's novels to a form of nonfiction. Ruth was extremely sensitive to her friend's Ruth character, Hannah character interpretations. In Ruth's second novel, Before the Fall of Saigon, 1985, the so-called Ruth and Hannah characters are roommates at Middlebury during the Vietnam War. The Hannah character, who is boldness personified, makes a deal with her boyfriend. She'll marry him and have his baby so that when he graduates and his student draft deferment expires, he will be protected from the draft under his new draft status, 3A, married with child. If the marriage doesn't work out, she makes him promise that he'll divorce her on her terms. She gets custody of the child. He pays child support. The problem is, she can't get pregnant. "How dare you call her the Hannah character?" Ruth asked Hannah repeatedly. You went through college trying not to get pregnant while managing to get pregnant every minute. But Hannah said that the character's capacity for risk-taking was entirely hers. In the novel, the woman who can't get pregnant, the Hannah character, makes a new deal, this time with her roommate, the Ruth character. The Hannah character convinces the Ruth character to sleep with the Hannah character's boyfriend and get pregnant with the boyfriend's baby. The deal is that the roommate, the Ruth character, will then marry the Hannah character's boyfriend, thus keeping him out of Vietnam. When the war, or the draft, is over, the dutiful roommate, who was a virgin before this dreadful experience, will divorce the boyfriend. He will immediately marry the Hannah character, and together they will raise the roommate's baby. How Hannah dared to call the virgin roommate the Ruth character was vexing to Ruth, who had not lost her virginity at college, much less got herself pregnant by means of Hannah's boyfriend. And Hannah Grant was her only friend who knew how and when Ruth had lost her virginity, which was another story. But Hannah said that the roommate's anxiety about losing her virginity was entirely Ruth's. In the novel, naturally, the Ruth character despises her roommate's boyfriend and is traumatized by their single sexual encounter. The boyfriend, on the other hand, falls in love with his girlfriend's roommate and balks at divorcing her when the Vietnam War is over. The fall of Saigon in April of 75 is the background to the end of the novel, when the roommate, who agrees to have her roommate's boyfriend's baby, realizes that she can't give the baby up. Her loathing of her baby's father notwithstanding, she accepts joint custody of their child upon their divorce. The Hannah character, who has instigated the match between her boyfriend and her best friend, loses both the boyfriend and the baby, not to mention the friendship with her former roommate. It is a sexual farce, but with bitter consequences, and its comic touches are offset by the darker rifts between the characters, which is a microcosm of how the country itself was divided by the war in Vietnam and, for Ruth's generation of young men, by what to do about the draft. A woman's quaint perspective on dodging the draft, one male reviewer wrote of the novel. Hannah had told Ruth that she had slept with this particular reviewer at one time or another. She also happened to know his draft-dodging story. The man had claimed psychological damage from having sex with his mother. His mother had substantiated the claim. The telling of the lie had been the mother's idea in the first place. And as a result of successfully evading the draft in this fashion, the man eventually had had sex with his mother. "I guess he knows a quaint perspective when he encounters one," Ruth had said. It irritated Hannah that Ruth didn't rail against her negative reviews as vociferously as Hannah railed against them. "Reviews are free publicity," Ruth liked to say, "even the bad ones." It was a measure of Ruth Cole's international stature and renown that the anticipation of her third and most recent novel was so keen in those European countries where she was translated that two translations were being published simultaneously with the British and American editions. Following her reading at the Y, Ruth was spending the next day in New York. She'd agreed to several interviews and to some related publicity. Then she was spending a day and a night in Sagaponack with her father before leaving for Germany and the Frankfurt Book Fair. After Frankfurt and the promotion of the German translation, she was expected in Amsterdam, where the Dutch translation had just been published. Ruth's visits with her father in Sagaponack were few, yet she was frankly looking forward to this one. Doubtless there would be a little squash in the barn, and much arguing about nearly everything, and even some rest. Hannah had promised to come to Sagaponack with her. It was always better for Ruth if she avoided spending time with her father alone. With a friend, even if it was one of Ruth's infrequent but consistently ill-chosen boyfriends, there was someone to run interference. But Hannah flirted with Ruth's father, which made Ruth cross. Ruth suspected Hannah of flirting with him because it made Ruth cross. And Ruth's father, who knew of no other way to behave with women, flirted back. It had been Hannah to whom Ruth had made her vulgar remark about her father's attractiveness to women, in which Ruth had said you could hear the women's panties sliding to the floor. When Hannah had first met Ted Cole, she'd said to Ruth, "What is that sound? Do you hear it?" Ruth rarely saw a joke coming. Her first thought always was that everyone was totally serious. "What sound? No, I don't hear it," Ruth had replied, looking around. "Oh, it's just my panties sliding to the floor," Hannah had told her. It had become a code between them. Whenever Ruth was introduced to one of Hannah's many boyfriends, if Ruth liked him, she would ask Hannah, "Did you hear that sound?" If Ruth didn't care for the boyfriend, which was often the case, Ruth would say, "I didn't hear a thing, did you?" Ruth was reluctant to introduce her boyfriends to Hannah, because Hannah always said, "What a racket! Boy, did something wet just hit the ground, or am I imagining things?" Wetness was a carryover in Hannah's sexual vocabulary. It went all the way back to their Exeter days. And Ruth was generally not proud of her boyfriends. She rarely wanted anyone to meet them. Nor were Ruth's boyfriends, usually in her life, long enough for Hannah to have to meet them. Yet now, as Ruth sat on a stool, enduring the stares of the stagehand who was enamored of her breasts, and enduring Eddie's laborious introduction to her life's work, poor Eddie was now bogged down in her second novel, Ruth thought again of her exasperation with Hannah for being late to her reading, or for not showing up at all. Not only had they talked with such excitement about the prospect of meeting Eddie O'Hare, but in the case of Ruth's present boyfriend, Ruth had very much wanted Hannah to meet him. Ruth felt, for once, that she actually needed to hear Hannah's opinion. There'd been so many times when Ruth wished that Hannah had withheld her opinion. "Now, when I need her, where is she?" Ruth wondered. Doubtless fucking her brains out, as Hannah would say. Or so Ruth imagined. She sighed deeply. She was aware of the rise and fall of her breasts, and of the idiot stagehand's rapt attention to this detail. She could have heard the lecherous young man sigh in response if Eddie hadn't been droning on and on. Out of boredom, Ruth met the young stagehand's stare and held it until he looked away. He had one of those wispy half-beards, a goatee in progress, and a mustache as insubstantial as soot. "If I neglected my regular wax job," Ruth thought, "I could grow a better mustache than that." She sighed again, daring the lech to take another look at her breasts, but the scruffy young man had suddenly grown self-conscious about staring at her. Therefore, Ruth made a concentrated effort to stare at him. She soon lost interest. His jeans were ripped open at one knee, probably the pair he preferred for public appearances. What was likely a food spill had left an oily stain on the chest of his dark brown turtleneck, which was stretched out of shape. Bulges the size of tennis balls hung at the elbows. But as soon as Ruth turned her attention to her pending reading, indeed the second she opened her new novel to the passage she'd chosen to read, the stagehand's feral gaze once more fell upon her heralded breasts. Ruth thought that he had confused eyes. They were alert but puzzled, a little like a dog's, one given to a slavish loyalty bordering on fawning. Then Ruth changed her mind about the passage she'd selected to read. She would read the first chapter instead. She hunched forward on the stagehand stool and held her open book in front of her, as she might have held a hymnal from which she was about to sing. Thus she obscured her breasts from the stagehand's view. It was a relief to Ruth that Eddie was finally addressing the subject of her third and most recent novel, a variation on Miss Cole's familiar theme of female friendships gone awry, Eddie was saying. More unmitigated sophistries, Ruth thought to herself. But there was a grain of truth to Eddie's thesis. Ruth had already heard a similar analysis from Hannah.
So, this time, Hannah had told her, the Ruth character and the Hannah character start out as enemies. In the end, we become friends. I agree it's different, but not very different. In Ruth's new novel, the Ruth character was a recent widow, a novelist named Jane Dash. It was the first time that Ruth had written about a writer. She was letting herself in for more autobiographical interpretations of the very kind she loathed. The Hannah character, who begins the novel as Mrs. Dash's enemy and ends the book as the widow's best friend, is named Eleanor Holt. The women who have long antagonized each other are brought together much against their wills by their grown children. Their son and daughter respectively fall in love and marry each other. Jane Dash, the mother of the groom, and Eleanor Holt, the mother of the bride, must share the responsibility of raising their grandchildren when the children's parents are killed in a plane crash. The trip was to be a second honeymoon for the young couple, who were celebrating their 10th anniversary. At the time of the plane crash, Mrs. Dash is already a widow. She never remarries. And Eleanor Holt is divorced for the second time. It was Ruth Cole's first novel to have an optimistic, if not altogether happy, ending, although Jane Dash remains uneasy about her friendship with Eleanor Holt on the basis of the sea changes in Eleanor's character which had so distinguished Eleanor's past. Hannah, fully recognizing Eleanor as the Hannah character, had taken offense at this line. "What sea changes have you observed in my character?" Hannah demanded to know. "You may not always approve of my behavior, but exactly what about my character is inconsistent or contradictory?" "There's nothing about you that's contradictory, Hannah," Ruth had told her friend. "And you're much more consistent than I am. I haven't noticed a single change in your character, not even a little change or a welcome change, much less a sea change." Hannah found this a confounding answer, and she said so. But Ruth merely suggested that this was evidence, if Hannah needed any, that Eleanor Holt was not the Hannah character that Hannah thought she was. It was there that an uneasy standoff between Ruth and Hannah had ended. At least until Ruth had invited Hannah to come hear her read from the novel, and that invitation had had less to do with the novel, which Hannah had already read, than with the exciting prospect of meeting Eddie O'Hare. The other person, whom Hannah had expressed an almost equal excitement for meeting, was the man Ruth had described to her as her present boyfriend. In truth, he was more in the category of a would-be boyfriend, a boyfriend candidate, as Hannah would say. This boyfriend-in-waiting also happened to be Ruth's new editor, that same very important person at Random House whom Eddie O'Hare had taken a dislike to on the basis of his avuncular heartiness, and of his never remembering that he'd met Eddie before. Yes, Ruth had already told Hannah he was the best editor she'd ever worked with. Yes, she had never, not to this degree, met a man she could talk to and listen to. Ruth felt there was no one, with the possible exception of Hannah, who knew her so well. Not only was he forthright and strong, but he challenged her in all the good ways. "What are the good ways?" Hannah had asked. "Oh, you'll meet him, you'll see," Ruth had told her. "He's also a gentleman." "He's old enough to be," Hannah had replied. "I mean, he's the right generation for gentlemanly behavior. What is he anyway, 12, 15 years older than you are?" She'd seen a photograph. 18, Ruth had said quietly. "That's a gentleman, all right," Hannah had said. "And doesn't he have children? My God, how old are they? They could be as old as you are." "He has no children," Ruth replied. "But I thought he was married for years and years," Hannah said. "Why doesn't he have children?" "His wife didn't want children. She was afraid of having children," Ruth said. "Sounds like you, sort of," Hannah said. "Alan wanted a child. His wife didn't," Ruth admitted. "So he still wants a child," Hannah concluded. "It's something we're talking about," Ruth confessed. "And I suppose he still talks to the ex-wife.
Let's hope that his will be the last generation of men who feels it's necessary to keep talking to their ex-wives, Hannah dismissively said. It was her journalist's sensibility. Everyone's statistics are presumed to comply to age, to education, to type. It was an infuriating way to think, but Ruth bit her tongue. Well, Hannah had added philosophically, I suppose the sex is all you expected? We haven't had sex yet, Ruth admitted. Who's waiting? Hannah asked. We both are. Ruth had lied. Alan was being patient. It was Ruth who was waiting. She was so afraid that she wouldn't like sex with him that she had procrastinated. She didn't want to have to stop thinking of him as the man in her life. But you said he asked you to marry him, Hannah had cried. He wants to marry you and he hasn't had sex with you yet? That's not even generational behavior. That's his father's generation or his grandfather's. He wants me to know that I'm not just another girlfriend to him, Ruth told Hannah. You're not yet a girlfriend at all, Hannah said. I think it's sweet, Ruth said. He's in love with me before he slept with me. I think it's nice. It's different, Hannah allowed. So what are you afraid of? I'm not afraid of anything, Ruth lied. You don't usually want me to meet your boyfriends, Hannah reminded her. This one's special, Ruth said. So special that you haven't slept with him. He can beat me at squash, Ruth added feebly. So can your father, and how old is he? 77, Ruth said. You know how old my father is. Jesus, is he really? He doesn't look it, Hannah said. I am talking about Alan Albright, not my father, Ruth said angrily. Alan Albright is only 54. He loves me. He wants to marry me, and I think I would be happy living with him. Did you say you loved him? Hannah asked. I didn't hear you say that. I didn't say that, Ruth admitted. I don't know that. I don't know how to tell, she added. If you can't tell, you don't love him, Hannah said. And I thought he had the reputation of... he was quite a ladies' man, wasn't he? Yes, he was, Ruth said slowly. He told me that himself and that he's changed. Uh-oh, Hannah said. Do men change? Do we? Ruth asked. You want to, don't you? Hannah said. I'm tired of bad boyfriends, Ruth confessed. You sure can pick them, Hannah told her. But I thought you picked them because you knew they were bad. I thought you picked them because you knew they'd go away, sometimes even before you tell them to. You've picked some bad boyfriends, too, Ruth said. Sure, all the time, Hannah admitted. But I've also picked some good ones. They just don't stay around. I think Alan will stay around, Ruth said. Sure he will, Hannah told her. So you're worried if you'll stay around, is that it? Yes, Ruth finally confessed. That's it. I want to meet him, Hannah said. I'll tell you if you'll stay around. I'll know the minute I meet him. And now she stood me up, Ruth thought. She thumped her copy of the novel shut. She held the book against her breasts. She felt like bursting into tears. She was so angry with Hannah, but she saw how she had startled the horny stagehand by her sudden gesture. She enjoyed his look of alarm. The audience can hear you backstage, the sly boy whispered to her. He had a supercilious smile. Ruth's response was not spontaneous. Almost everything she said was deliberate. In case you've been wondering, Ruth whispered to the stagehand, they're 34D. What? The boy whispered. He's too dumb to get it, Ruth decided. Besides, the audience had broken into a resounding applause. Without hearing what Eddie had said, Ruth understood that Eddie had finally finished. She paused to shake his hand on stage before approaching the podium.
Eddie, confused, walked backstage instead of to his reserved seat in the audience. Once backstage, he was too embarrassed to go to his seat. He looked helplessly at the unfriendly stagehand, who was not about to offer Eddie his stool. Ruth waited out the applause. She picked up her empty water glass and immediately put it down.
"Oh, God, I drank her water," Eddie realized.
"What a set of hooters, huh?"
the stagehand whispered to Eddie, who said nothing but looked guilty. He hadn't heard what the stagehand said. Eddie assumed it was something about the glass of water. For his small part in the evening's proceedings, the stagehand suddenly felt smaller than usual. No sooner had the word Hooters died on his lips than the shallow young man grasped what the famous novelist had whispered to him.
"She's a 34D,
the slow-witted fool realized.
But why had she told him? Was she coming on to me or what?
The moron wondered. When the applause had at last died down, Ruth said, "Would you turn up the house lights a little, please? I want to be able to see my editor's face. If I see him cringe, I'll know there's something I missed or something he missed." It got a laugh, as it was intended to do, but that wasn't entirely why she had said it. She didn't need to see Alan Albright's face. He was enough on her mind already. What Ruth wanted to see was the empty seat beside Alan, the seat that had been reserved for Hannah Grant. Actually, there were two empty seats beside Alan, because Eddie had become trapped backstage, but Ruth noticed only Hannah's absence.
"God damn you, Hannah," Ruth thought.
But she was on stage now. All she needed to do was cast her eyes on the page. Her writing completely absorbed her. Outwardly, she was what Ruth Cole always was, composed. And as soon as she began to read, she would feel inwardly composed, too. She might not know what to do about boyfriends, especially one who wanted to marry her, and she might not know how to deal with her father, for whom her feelings were sorely mixed. She might not know whether to hate her best friend, Hannah, or to forgive her. But when it came to her writing, Ruth Cole was the picture of confidence and concentration. In fact, she was concentrating so completely on reading the first chapter, which was called The Red and Blue Air Mattress, that she forgot to tell the audience the title of her new novel. No matter. Most of them already knew the title. More than half the people in the audience had read the whole book. The first chapter's origins were peculiar. The magazine section of a German newspaper, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, had asked Ruth to submit a short story for the annual fiction issue. Ruth rarely wrote short stories. There was always a novel on her mind, even if she hadn't begun to write it. But the rules regarding the submission to the Süddeutsche Zeitung intrigued her. Every short story published in the magazine was called The Red and Blue Air Mattress. And at least once in every story, an actual red and blue air mattress had to make an appearance. It was further suggested that the air mattress had to be of sufficient significance to the story to merit its existence as a title. Ruth liked rules. For most writers, rules were laughable, but Ruth was also a squash player. She had a fondness for games. The fun for Ruth was where and how to bring the air mattress into the story. She already knew who her characters were. They would be Jane Dash, newly a widow, and Mrs. Dash's then-enemy, Eleanor Holt. "And so," Ruth told the audience at the 92nd Street Y, "I owe my first chapter to an air mattress." The audience laughed. It was now a game for the audience, too. It was Eddie O'Hare's impression that even the boorish stagehand was full of anticipation for the red and blue air mattress. It was further testimony to how international a writer Ruth Cole had become. The first chapter of her new novel had been published in German, under the title Die blau-rote Luftmatratze, before any of Ruth's many readers could read it in English. Ruth told the audience, "I want to dedicate this reading to my best friend, Hannah Grant. One day, Hannah would hear of the dedication she had missed. Someone in the audience would be sure to mention it to her. You could have heard a pin drop, as they say, when Ruth began to read her first chapter. The Red and Blue Air Mattress. She'd been a widow for 1 year, yet Jane Dash was as prone to being swept away by a so-called flood of memories as she was on that morning when she'd awakened with her husband dead beside her. She was a novelist. She had no intentions of writing a memoir. Autobiography didn't interest her, her own especially. But she did want to keep her memories of the past under control, as any widow must. A most unwelcome intrusion from Mrs. Dash's past was the former hippie Eleanor Holt. Eleanor was drawn to the misfortunes of others. Truly, she seemed uplifted by them. Widows in particular appealed to her. Eleanor was living evidence of Mrs. Dash's conviction that poetic justice is not forthcoming on a regular basis. Not even Plutarch could convince Jane Dash that Eleanor Holt would ever receive her just rewards. What was it called, what Plutarch had written? Jane thought it was Why the Gods Are So Slow to Punish the Wicked. But she couldn't exactly remember. Anyway, despite the centuries that separated them, Plutarch must have had Eleanor Holt in mind. Mrs. Dash's late husband had once referred to Eleanor as a woman under the constant pressure of revising herself. Jane thought this assessment was overly kind. When she was first married, Eleanor Holt was one of those women who flaunted the happiness of her marriage to such a degree that anyone who'd ever been divorced cordially loathed her. When she was newly divorced, Eleanor became such an advocate of divorce that anyone who was happily married wanted to kill her. In the 60s, to no one's surprise, she was a socialist. In the 70s, a feminist. When she lived in New York, she thought that life in the Hamptons, which she called the country, was suitable only for fair-weather weekends. To live in the Hamptons year-round or in bad weather was strictly for bumpkins and other dullards. When she left Manhattan for a year-round residence in the Hamptons and for her second marriage, she pronounced that city life was fit only for sexual predators and thrill-seekers who were without her capacity for self-knowledge. After many years in Bridgehampton, Eleanor continued to think of the South Fork of Long Island as rural, for she had no experience with genuine country living. She had attended an all-women's college in Massachusetts, and while she looked back on her experience there as decidedly unnatural, she did not categorize it as either rural or urban. Eleanor had once burned her bra in public before a small gathering in a Grand Union parking lot, but throughout the 80s she was a politically active Republican, the alleged influence of her second husband. Having tried unsuccessfully for years to get pregnant, she finally conceived her only child with the aid of an anonymous sperm donor. Thereupon, she became adamantly opposed to abortion. Possibly this was the alleged influence of what Mrs. Dash's late husband called the mystery sperm. During 2 decades, Eleanor Holt went from eating everything to strict vegetarianism, to eating everything again. The changes in her diet were confusingly imposed upon her sperm-donated child, a haunted girl whose birthday party, she was only 6 at the time, was spoiled for her and for the other children in attendance by Eleanor's decision to show the home movie of her daughter's birth. Jane Dash's only son had been one of the traumatized children at the birthday party. The episode had troubled Mrs. Dash, for she had always been physically modest in the presence of her son. Her late husband had frequently been naked around the house. He slept in the nude, and so forth, but this hadn't troubled Jane, at least not for her son's sake. After all, they were both boys. Jane, however, had made every effort to cover herself. Then her son had come home from the Holt girls' birthday party, having seen an apparently vivid film of a live birth, having seen Eleanor Holt displayed like an open book. And over the years, Eleanor would from time to time impose the obstetrical film on her poor daughter, and not necessarily for educational reasons. Rather, it was for Eleanor Holt's unstoppable self-importance. The woman needed to demonstrate to her own daughter how, at least at the moment of giving birth, she had suffered. As for the daughter, she either developed or had been born with a contrary personality. Whether this was the result of her overexposure to the gore of her own delivery, or something in the secret genes of the mystery sperm, the daughter seemed intent on embarrassing her mother. And the poor girl's contrariness encouraged Eleanor to attack other possible sources that might be disturbing her daughter. For Eleanor Holt never faulted herself, not for anything. What Mrs. Dash would always remember was Eleanor Holt's emergence as an anti-pornography picketer. The porn shop, which was on the outskirts of Riverhead, Long Island, a far cry from the Hamptons, was not a place that lured young or unsuspecting or otherwise innocent readers to its door. It was a low, shingled building with small windows and a shed roof. The sign outside was not ambiguous. X-rated books and magazines. Adults only. Eleanor and a small band of outraged, matronly women only once entered the building. They abruptly withdrew, agitated and flushed. "The strong victimizing the weak," Eleanor told a local reporter. The couple who ran the pornography shop were elderly. They had been longing to escape the dreary Long Island winters. In the ensuing fuss, they conned a concerned citizens' group of Eleanor's initiation into buying the building. But the concerned citizens not only paid too much for the old shed, they were left with, the inventory, as Mrs. Dash thought of it. As a novelist, and as an interested party, Jane Dash volunteered to estimate the value of the stock. She had previously but politely declined an invitation to join Eleanor's crusade against pornography, on the grounds that she was a writer. She was basically opposed to censorship. When Eleanor pressed her case that she was appealing to Jane as a woman first and a writer second, Jane had surprised both Eleanor and herself by her response. "I'm a writer first," Mrs. Dash had said. Jane was allowed to investigate the pornography at her leisure. Its value aside, Mrs. Dash found it disappointing. The coarseness of it was to be expected, apparently not by Eleanor Holt. But grossness was the norm for many people. Crudeness and prurient interests were the motivating humors for all sorts of individuals. Mrs. Dash happily did not associate with them. Whereas she wished more of the population were better educated, she also believed that education was largely wasted on the majority of people she had met. In the unseemly collection from the porn shop, now closed for good outside Riverhead, there were no depictions of sexual acts with animals or with underage children. Mrs. Dash considered it mildly reassuring that these depravities had not made their way as far east of Manhattan as Suffolk County, at least not in magazine or book form. What she found in ample evidence was the commonplace exaggeration of female orgasms, and men, always with penises of unlikely size, who displayed an unconvincing interest in the labors they were performing. Bad acting on the part of both sexes, Jane Dash concluded. She thought the close-up views of the countless and various female genitalia were, well, clinically interesting. She'd never before looked at other women in such uninviting detail. Pressed for her evaluation, Jane declared the contents of the shop to be worthless trash. Unless the concerned citizens wanted to reduce their expenses by selling off the remaining stock to certain curious locals. But such a sidewalk sale in Riverhead would have amounted to the concerned citizens playing the role of pornographers. Therefore, the books and magazines were burned. A total loss. Again defining herself as a writer first, Mrs. Dash said she wanted no part of the burning ceremony. She wouldn't even watch it. The local newspapers captured a small but triumphant band of women tending to a fire. Real firemen stood anxiously nearby in case the burning photographs of strenuous sexual endeavors and stray genitals should suddenly develop into a spreading flame. In Suffolk County, 6 years passed without further public demonstrations in the field of sexual morality. The sperm-donated daughter was 12 when she took Eleanor Holt's dildo, a battery-powered vibrator, to the local Bridgehampton Alternative School for that ill-considered part of American education known as show and tell. Once again, Jane Dash's son, who'd been witness to the film of the live birth at the 6-year-old's birthday party, was privileged to see this brief glimpse of Eleanor's formerly private experience. The 12-year-old daughter was fortunately inexpert at demonstrating the tool, which the astonished teacher quickly took away from her. There was little more to observe than the shocking size of the thing. Mrs. Dash, who never saw it, gathered from her son's description that the dildo was modeled on nothing resembling an actual male member. The boy compared the vibrator to some kind of missile. Also fixed in the lad's memory was the sound that the missile made when it was turned on. The vibrator, of course, vibrated. While this was not highly detectable, before the teacher grabbed the dildo from the 12-year-old and turned it off, the particular sound was a surprise to all who heard it. "Exactly what did it sound like?" Jane asked her son. "Zzt, zzt, zzt," the boy reported. There was a hint of warning in this sound, Mrs. Dash thought. A buzzing sound with a T on the end. The novelist couldn't get this sound out of her head. And here the playfulness of Mrs. Dash's late husband would return to haunt her. Whenever they had spotted Eleanor Holt at a dinner party, in the supermarket, or dropping off her daughter at the alternative school, Jane's husband would whisper in the novelist's ear, "Zzzt." It seemed to Jane that, in his clever way, he was telling her to be careful. Repeatedly, it was the sheer good fun of him that Mrs. Dash missed most of all. Even the sight of Eleanor Holt would forcefully remind Jane of her widowhood and what she'd lost. 5 more years passed, yet Jane remembered the dildo episode as if it had happened only yesterday. What possessed Mrs. Dash to confront Eleanor Holt with an almost perfect imitation of the sound made by her vibrator was twofold. Jane keenly desired to bring back to her life her late husband's sense of humor. And Jane knew that if she didn't do something to Eleanor directly, she would be driven to write about her, which would be worse. As a novelist, Mrs. Dash despised writing about real people. She found it a failure of the imagination, for any novelist worthy of the name ought to be able to invent a more interesting character than any real person. To turn Eleanor Holt into fiction, even for the purpose of derision, would be a kind of flattery. Besides, the moment of Mrs. Dash's decision to imitate the sound of Eleanor's vibrator was no decision at all. It was completely accidental. It was not, quite unlike a Jane Dash novel, a planned act.
The situation was the annual picnic for the alternative school, which was an alternative kind of school picnic, coming as it did well after the close of the school year. It was intended to coincide with the first good swimming weather of the early summer. The Atlantic Ocean was exceedingly cold until late June, but if the school waited for its picnic as long as July, the public beach would be overcrowded with the summer renters. Mrs. Dash had no intentions of swimming before August. She never swam at the school picnics, not even when her husband had been alive. And since her son had graduated from the alternative school, his attendance and Jane's at this year's picnic was more in the spirit of an alumni gathering, a reunion of sorts, which also marked Mrs. Dash's most public outing in Bridgehampton since she'd become a widow. Some were surprised to see her, not Eleanor Holt. "Good for you," Eleanor said to Jane. "It's about time you went out in the world again." That was probably what set Mrs. Dash to thinking. She hardly considered the alternative school's picnic as the world, nor did she care to be congratulated by Eleanor Holt. Jane distracted herself with pleasant observations of her son, how he had grown. And his former schoolmates, well, they had grown up too. Even Eleanor's troubled daughter was quite a pretty girl, relaxed and outgoing, now that she was in a boarding school and wasn't living in the same house with the lurid movie of her own birth and her mother's nuclear missile of pleasure. Jane also distracted herself by observing the smaller children. She didn't know many of them, and some of the younger parents were strangers to her as well. The teacher who'd taken away the vibrating dildo came and sat beside Mrs. Dash. Jane didn't hear what she was saying. The novelist was trying to imagine how to frame her question and if she dared to ask it. "When you grabbed hold of the thing, how hard was it shaking? I mean, like a blender, maybe, or a food processor? Or was it, gentler than that?" But of course Mrs. Dash would never ask such a question. She just smiled. Eventually the teacher wandered away. As the afternoon darkened, the younger children shivered with cold. The beach turned an eggshell brown color, the ocean turned gray. There were shivering children in the parking lot, too, as Mrs. Dash and her son put their picnic basket and their towels and beach blankets into the trunk of their car. They were parked beside Eleanor Holt and her daughter. Jane was surprised to see Eleanor's second husband. He was an excessively litigious divorce lawyer who rarely appeared at social events. A wind came up. The younger children moaned. Something colorful, it looked like a raft, was lifted by the wind. It flew out of the hands of a small boy and landed on the roof of Eleanor Holt's car. The divorce lawyer reached for the colorful thing, but it flew on. Jane Dash caught it in the air. It was a partially deflated air mattress, red and blue, and the little boy who'd lost control of it came running up to Mrs. Dash. "I was trying to let the air out of it," the little boy said. "It won't fit in the car. Then it got away in the wind." "Well, now, let me show you. There's a trick to this," Mrs. Dash told the boy. Jane was watching Eleanor Holt bend over. Eleanor knelt down on one knee. She was tying her shoe. Her litigious husband had aggressively positioned himself at the steering wheel. Her mystery sperm daughter was sitting sullenly alone in the back seat, doubtless returned to her childhood horrors by this reunion. Jane found a pebble of the right size in the parking lot. She unscrewed the cap that covered the air valve for the red and blue air mattress, and she stuck the pebble into the valve. The pebble pressed the valve needle down. The air hissed out. "Just push down on the pebble," Mrs. Dash said. She demonstrated for the small boy, "like this." The air escaped the mattress in sudden blasts. "And if you hug the mattress hard, like this, it will deflate faster." But when Jane did this, the air rattled the pebble against the valve.
Eleanor heard the sound just as she was standing up.
Zzzt, zzzt, zzzt,
said the red and blue air mattress. The delight in the little boy's face was apparent. It was quite a wonderful sound to him. But in Eleanor Holt's expression was the sudden recognition that she had been exposed. At the steering wheel, her husband turned his face, like a lawsuit, to the sound. Then Eleanor's daughter turned to face the sound, too. Even Jane Dash's son, twice introduced to the intimate life of Eleanor Holt, turned in recognition of the thrilling sound. Eleanor stared at Mrs. Dash and at the rapidly deflating air mattress like a woman who'd been undressed before a mob. "It is about time I went out in the world again," Jane admitted to Eleanor. Yet on the subject of the world and what it was, and when it was time for a widow to re-enter it safely, the red and blue air mattress offered only a cautionary word.
Zzzt.
Alan, at 54. Ruth had read aloud, in a deadpan voice. Some of the audience seemed disconcerted by her final zzzt. Eddie, who'd read the whole book twice, loved the ending of the first chapter, but a portion of the audience briefly withheld their applause. They weren't sure the chapter had ended. The stupid stagehand stared open-mouthed at the TV monitor as if he were preparing himself to deliver an epilogue. Not a single word was forthcoming, not even another charmless comment regarding his tireless appreciation of the famous novelist's Hooters. It was Alan Albright who clapped first, even before Eddie. As Ruth Cole's editor, Alan well knew the zzzt with which the first chapter concluded. The applause that eventually followed was generous, and it was sufficiently sustained for Ruth to appraise the solitary ice cube in the bottom of her water glass. The ice had melted enough to provide her with a single swallow. The questions and answers that followed the reading were a disappointment. Eddie felt badly for Ruth that, after an entertaining performance, she had to suffer through the anticlimax that questions from the audience always engendered. And throughout the entire Q&A, Alan Albright had frowned at Ruth as if she could have done something to elevate the intelligence of the questions. During her reading, Alan's animated expressions in the audience had irritated her, as if it was his role to entertain Ruth at her own reading. The first question was openly hostile. It set a tone which the subsequent questions and answers could not break free of. "Why do you repeat yourself?" a young man asked the author. "Or is it unintentional?" Ruth judged him to be in his late 20s. Admittedly, the house lights were not bright enough for her to see his exact expression. He was seated near the back of the concert hall, but from his tone of voice, Ruth had no doubt that he was sneering at her. After three novels, Ruth was familiar with the charge that her characters were recycled from one book to the next, and that there were also signature eccentricities that she repeated in novel after novel. "I suppose I do develop a fairly limited cast of characters," Ruth considered. But in her experience, people who accused an author of repetition were usually referring to a detail that they hadn't liked the first time. After all, even in literature, if one likes something, what is the objection to repeating it? "I presume you mean the dildo," Ruth said to the accusing young man. There had been a dildo in her second novel, too. But no dildo had reared its head, so to speak, in her first novel, doubtless an oversight, Ruth thought to herself. What she said was, "I know that many of you young men feel threatened by dildos, but you really needn't worry that you'll ever be entirely replaced." She paused for the laughter. Then she added, "And this dildo is really not at all the same type of dildo as the dildo in my previous novel. Not every dildo is the same, you know."
You repeat more than dildos, the young man commented.
Yes, I know, female friendships gone awry, or lost and found again, Ruth remarked, realizing, only after she spoke, that she was quoting from Eddie O'Hare's tedious introduction. Backstage, Eddie at first felt awfully pleased. Then he wondered if she'd been mocking him.
Bad boyfriends, the persistent young man added. Now there was a theme.
The boyfriend in the same orphanage was a decent guy, Ruth reminded her antagonistic reader.
No mothers, shouted an older woman in the audience.
No fathers either, Ruth snapped.
Alan Albright was holding his head in his hands. He had advised her against Q&A. He'd told her that if she couldn't let a hostile or a baiting remark go, if she couldn't just let it lie, she should not do Q&A, and she shouldn't be so ready to bite back.
But I like to bite back, Ruth had told him.
But you shouldn't bite back the first time, or even the second, Alan had warned her. His motto was, be nice twice.
On principle, Ruth approved of the idea, but she found it hard advice to follow.
Alan's notion was that you ignored the first and the second rudeness. If someone baited you or was plainly hostile to you a third time, then you let him have it. Maybe this was too gentlemanly a principle for Ruth to adhere to.
The sight of Alan with his head in his hands caused Ruth to resent his demonstrable disapproval.
Why was she so frequently in a mood to find fault with him? For the most part, she admired Alan's habits, at least his work habits, and she had no doubt that he was a good influence on her.
What Ruth Cole needed was an editor for her life, more than for her novels. Even Hannah Grant would have agreed with her.
Next question? Ruth asked.
She had tried to sound cheerful, even inviting, but there was no hiding the animosity in her voice. She'd not extended an invitation to her audience. She'd issued a challenge.
Where do you get your ideas? Some innocent soul asked the author.
It was someone unseen, a strangely sexless voice in the vast hall. Alan rolled his eyes. It was what Alan called the shopping question. The homey speculation that one shopped for the ingredients in a novel.
My novels aren't ideas. I don't have any ideas, Ruth replied. I begin with the characters, which leads me to the problems that the characters are prone to have, which yields a story, every time.
Backstage, Eddie felt as if he should be taking notes.
Is it true that you never had a job, a real job?
It was the impertinent young man again, the one who'd asked her why she repeated herself.
She hadn't called on him. He was at her again, uninvited.
It was true that Ruth had never had a real job, but before Ruth could respond to the insinuating question, Alan Albright stood up and turned around, doubtless in order to address the uncivil young man in the back of the concert hall.
Being a writer is a real job, you asshole, Alan said.
Ruth knew he'd been counting. By his count, he'd been nice twice. Medium applause followed Alan's outburst. When Alan turned toward the stage to face Ruth, he gave her his characteristic cue, the thumb of his right hand drawn across his throat like a knife. This meant, get off the stage.
Thank you again, Ruth told the audience.
On her way backstage, she stopped once. She turned and waved to the audience. Their applause was still warm.
How come you don't autograph books? Every other writer signs books, her persecutor called.
Before she continued on her way backstage, Alan stood and turned again. Ruth didn't have to watch him. She already knew that Alan would give her tormentor the finger. Alan was extraordinarily fond of giving people the finger.
I really do like him, and he really will take care of me, she thought.
Yet Ruth couldn't deny that Alan also irritated her. Back in the green room, Alan irritated her again. The first thing he said to her was, "You never mentioned the title of the book."
"I just forgot," Ruth said. What was he, always an editor?
"I didn't think you were going to read the first chapter," Alan added. "You told me you thought it was too comic and that it didn't represent the novel as a whole."
"I changed my mind," Ruth told him. I decided I wanted to be comic. "You were no barrel of laughs in the Q&A," he reminded her.
"At least I didn't call anyone an asshole," Ruth said.
"I gave the guy his 2 times," Alan replied. An elderly lady with a shopping bag of books had negotiated her way backstage. She'd lied to someone who had tried to stop her. She'd said she was Ruth's mother. She tried to lie to Eddie, too. She found Eddie standing in the doorway of the green room. Indecisive as always, Eddie was half in, half out. The old woman with the shopping bag mistook him for someone in charge. "I've got to see Ruth Cole," the elderly lady told Eddie. Eddie saw the books in the shopping bag. "Ruth Cole doesn't autograph books," Eddie warned the old woman. "She never signs."
"Let me in. I'm her mother," the old lady lied.
Eddie, of all people, didn't need to look very closely at the elderly woman, only enough to realize that she was about the same age as Marion would be now. Marion would be 71.
"Madam," Eddie said to the old woman, "you are not Ruth Cole's mother."
But Ruth had heard someone say she was her mother. She pushed past Alan to the doorway of the green room where the elderly lady seized her hand.
"I brought these books all the way from Litchfield for you to sign," the old woman said. "That's in Connecticut."
"You shouldn't lie about being someone's mother," Ruth told her.
"There's one for each of my grandchildren," the old lady said.
There were a half dozen of Ruth's novels in the shopping bag, but before the elderly woman could begin removing the books from the bag, Alan was there, his big hand on the old lady's shoulder. He was gently pushing her out the door.
"It was announced, Ruth Cole doesn't autograph books. She simply does not do it," Alan said. "I'm sorry, but if she signed your books, it wouldn't be fair to all the other people who also want her signature, would it?"
The old woman ignored him. She had not let go of Ruth's hand.
"My grandchildren adore everything you've written," she told Ruth. "It will take you just 2 minutes."
Ruth stood as if frozen.
"Please," Alan said to the lady with the shopping bag, but the old lady, with surprising quickness, put down her bag of books and knocked Alan's hand off her shoulder. "Don't you dare push me," the old woman said.
"She's not my mother, is she?" Ruth asked Eddie.
"No, of course not," Eddie told her. "Look, I'm asking you to sign these books for my grandchildren, your own books," the elderly lady said to Ruth. "I bought these books."
"Madam, please," Alan said to the old woman.
"What on earth is the matter with you anyway?" the old woman asked Ruth. "Fuck you and your grandchildren," Ruth said to her.
The old lady looked as if she'd been slapped.
"What did you say to me?" she asked.
She had an imperiousness that Hannah would have called generational, but which Ruth thought was more a matter of the obnoxious old woman's wealth and privilege. Surely the woman's pushiness wasn't strictly a matter of her age. Ruth reached into the shopping bag and took out one of her own novels.
"Do you have a pen?"
she asked Eddie, who fumbled inside his damp jacket and produced a red pen, his teacher's favorite. As Ruth inscribed the old woman's book, she repeated aloud the words as she wrote them,
"Fuck you and your grandchildren."
She put the book back in the bag and would have withdrawn another. She would have inscribed them all in that fashion and left them all unsigned, but the old woman grabbed the shopping bag away from her.
"How dare you?" the elderly lady cried.
"Fuck you and your grandchildren," Ruth repeated flatly. It was her voice for reading aloud. She went back inside the green room, saying to Alan in passing,
"Fuck being nice twice. Fuck being nice once."
Eddie, who knew that his introduction had been too long and too academic, saw a way to atone. Whoever the old woman was, she was about Marion's age. Eddie did not look upon women of Marion's age as old. They were older women, of course, but they were not elderly, not in Eddie's opinion. Eddie had seen a printed book plate on the inside title page that Ruth had inscribed for the aggressive grandmother, Elizabeth J. Benton.
"Mrs. Benton?" Eddie asked the older woman. "What?" Mrs. Benton said. "Who are you?"
"Ed O'Hare," Eddie said, offering the older woman his hand.
"That's an admirable brooch you have."
Mrs. Benton stared at the lapel of her plum-colored suit jacket. Her brooch was a scallop shell of silver studded with pearls.
It was my mother's, the older woman told Eddie.
Isn't that interesting? Eddie said. My mother had one just like it. In fact, she was buried with it.
Eddie lied. Eddie's mom, Dot O'Hare, was still very much alive.
Oh, Mrs. Benton said, I'm sorry.
Eddie's long fingers seemed suspended above the older woman's intensely ugly brooch. Mrs. Benton, swelling her breast in the direction of Eddie's hovering hand, allowed him to touch the scallop shell of silver. She let him finger her pearls.
I never thought I'd see a brooch like this again, Eddie said.
Oh, Mrs. Benton said. Were you very close to your mother? You must have been very close.
Yes, Eddie lied.
Why can't I do this in my books, he wondered.
It was a mystery where the lies came from, and why he couldn't summon them when he wanted them. It was as if he could only wait and hope for a good enough lie to appear at the opportune moment.
Minutes later, Eddie had walked the older woman to the stage entrance door. Outside, in the steady rain, a small but determined gathering of young people were waiting for a glimpse of Ruth Cole and to ask her to sign their books.
The author has already left. She went out the front door, Eddie lied.
It amazed him that he'd been incapable of lying to the woman at the registration desk in the plaza. If only he'd been able to lie to her, he'd have got change for the bus a little sooner. He might even have had the good luck to catch an earlier bus.
Mrs. Benton, who was more in command of her capabilities as a liar than Eddie O'Hare, basked for a moment longer in Eddie's company before she bid him a lilting good night. She made a point of thanking him for his gentlemanly behavior. Eddie had volunteered to get Ruth Cole's autograph for Mrs. Benton's grandchildren. He'd persuaded the older woman to leave her shopping bag of books with him, including the book that Ruth had spoiled. That was how Mrs. Benton thought of it. Eddie knew that if he couldn't get Ruth's signature, he could at least provide Mrs. Benton with a reasonably convincing forgery. Eddie would have confessed to a fondness for Mrs. Benton's boldness. Her assertion that she was Ruth's mother notwithstanding, Eddie had admired the way she'd stood up to Alan Albright. There was also something bold about Mrs. Benton's amethyst earrings. Something too bold, perhaps. They were not quite right with the more muted plum color of her suit. And the big ring that hung a little too loosely from her right middle finger, perhaps it had once fit the ring finger of that hand. Eddie had a soft spot for the thinning and caving in of Mrs. Benton's body, too, for he could tell that Mrs. Benton still thought of herself as a younger woman. How could she not think of herself as younger sometimes? How could Eddie not be moved by her? And like most writers, Ted Cole excluded, Eddie O'Hare believed that a writer's autograph was intrinsically unimportant. Why not do for Mrs. Benton what he could? What did it matter to Mrs. Benton that Ruth Cole's reasons for avoiding public book signings were well-founded? Ruth hated how exposed she felt when she was signing books for a mob. There was always someone who just stared at her. Often it was someone standing to one side of the line, usually without a book. Publicly, Ruth had said that when she was in Helsinki, she would sign books, her Finnish translations, because she couldn't speak Finnish. In Finland, there was nothing she could do but autograph her books. But in her own country, or anywhere where they spoke English, she would rather read to an audience or just talk to her readers, anything, rather than sign books. Yet in truth, she didn't like talking to her readers either, as was painfully apparent to anyone observing her agitation during the disastrous Q&A at the Y. Ruth Cole was afraid of her readers. She'd had her share of stalkers. Usually Ruth's stalkers were creepy young men. They presumed they already knew her because of how obsessively they'd read her novels. They presumed they would be good for her in some way, as lovers, they often implied, or merely as like-minded literary correspondents. Many of them were would-be writers, of course. Yet the few women who'd stalked her
had upset Ruth more than the creepy young man. They were often women who wanted Ruth to write their stories. They thought they belonged in a Ruth Cole novel. Ruth wanted her privacy. She traveled frequently. She could happily write in hotels or in a variety of rented houses and apartments, surrounded by other people's photographs and furniture and clothes, or even caring for other people's pets. Ruth owned only one home, an old farmhouse in Vermont, which she was half-heartedly restoring. She'd bought the farmhouse only because she needed to have a place to keep coming back to, and because a caretaker had virtually come with the property. A young man and his wife and family lived nearby on a working farm. They were a couple with a seemingly uncountable number of small children. Ruth tried to keep them busy with odd jobs and with the larger task of restoring her farmhouse, one room at a time, and always when Ruth was traveling. For 4 years at Middlebury, Ruth and Hannah had complained about the isolation of Vermont, not to mention the winters, because neither of them was a skier. Now, Ruth loved Vermont, even the winters, and she enjoyed having a house in the country, but she liked going away too. Her traveling was the simple answer she gave to the question of why she hadn't married and why she didn't want children. Alan Albright was too smart to accept the simple answer. They had talked and talked about Ruth's more complex reasons for saying no to marriage and to children. Except with Hannah, Ruth had never before discussed the more complex reasons. She particularly regretted that she'd never discussed them with her father. Back in the green room, Ruth thanked Eddie for his welcome and timely interference with Mrs. Benton. "It seems I have a way with her age group," Eddie admitted, without irony, Ruth observed. She'd also observed that Eddie had returned with Mrs. Benton's bag of books. Even Alan managed some gruff congratulations, which amounted to his overmanly approval of Eddie's heroics with the relentless autograph seeker. "Well done, O'Hare!" Alan heartily exclaimed. He was one of those bluff men who called other men by their last names. Hannah would have cited the last name usage as a distinguishing habit of Alan's generation. Finally, it had stopped raining. As they left by the stage entrance door, Ruth told Alan and Eddie how grateful she was to them. "I know that you both did your best to save me from myself," she told them.
"It's not yourself you need saving from," Alan said to Ruth. "It's the assholes."
"No, it's myself I need saving from," Ruth thought. But she just smiled at Alan and squeezed his arm. Eddie, who was silent, was thinking that Ruth needed saving from herself and from the assholes, and possibly from Alan Albright. Speaking of assholes, there was one waiting for Ruth on 2nd Avenue between 84th and 85th. He must have guessed the restaurant they were going to, or he'd been clever enough to follow Carl and Melissa there. It was the impudent young man from the rear of the concert hall, the one with the needling questions.
"I want to apologize," he said to Ruth. "It wasn't my intention to make you angry."
He didn't sound very apologetic. "You didn't make me angry at you," Ruth told him, not entirely truthfully. "I get angry with myself every time I go out in public. I shouldn't let myself go out in public."
"But why is that?" the young man asked.
"You've asked enough questions, fella," Alan told him.
When Alan called someone fella, he was willing to have a fight.
"I get angry with myself when I expose myself in public," Ruth said.
Suddenly she added, "Oh, God, you're a journalist, aren't you?"
"You don't like journalists, do you?"
the young journalist asked. Ruth left him outside the restaurant, where he went on arguing with Alan for an interminable amount of time. Eddie stayed with Alan and the journalist, but only briefly. He came into the restaurant and joined Ruth, who was sitting with Carl and Melissa. "They're not going to get into a fight," Eddie assured Ruth. "If they were going to have a fight, they already would have." It turned out that the journalist was someone who'd not been granted an interview with Ruth tomorrow. Apparently, the publicist at Random House hadn't thought he was important enough, and Ruth always put a limit on how many interviews she would do. "You don't have to do any," Alan had told her, but she'd yielded to the publicity people. Alan was notorious at Random House for undermining the efforts of the publicity people. His idea of a novelist, even of a best-selling novelist like Ruth Cole, was that a novelist should stay home and write. What his authors appreciated about Alan Albright was that he didn't burden them with all the other expectations publishers have. He was devoted to his authors. Sometimes Alan was more devoted to his authors' actual writing than the authors themselves were. Ruth never doubted that she loved that aspect of Alan. But that he was unafraid to criticize her about anything was an aspect of Alan that Ruth did not so wholeheartedly adore. While Alan was still out on the sidewalk arguing with the aggressive young journalist, Ruth quickly signed the books in Mrs. Benton's shopping bag, including the one she had spoiled. On that one she wrote, "Sorry," in parentheses. Then Eddie hid the shopping bag under the table because Ruth told him that Alan would be disappointed in her for signing the self-assertive grandmother's books. The way Ruth said it, Eddie surmised that Alan took more than an editorial interest in his renowned author. When Alan at last joined them at the table, Eddie was alert to Alan's other interest in Ruth. Ruth was alert to Alan's other interest in her, too. During the editing of her novel, including their bitter argument about the title, she'd not sensed Alan's romantic inclination toward her. He'd been strictly business, an absolute professional. Nor had she seen, at the time, that his dislike of her chosen title had grown curiously personal. That she wouldn't yield to him, she wouldn't even consider his suggested alternative, had affected him oddly. He bore the title like a grudge. He referred to it obdurately in the manner that a vexed husband might repeatedly mention an enduring disagreement in a long and otherwise successful marriage. She called her third novel Not for Children. Indeed, it was not. In the novel, it is a slogan favored by the anti-pornography picketers. The slogan is the invention of Mrs. Dash's enemy, who would eventually become her friend, Eleanor Holt. However, in the course of the novel, the phrase comes to mean something quite different from its original intent. In their mutual need to love and raise their orphaned grandchildren, Eleanor Holt and Jane Dash realize that their expressed disapproval of each other must be set aside. Their old antagonisms are also not for children. Alan had wanted to call the novel For the Children's Sake. He'd said that the two adversaries make friends in the manner of a couple who endure a bad marriage for the children's sake. But Ruth wanted to keep the anti-pornography connection that was both explicit and implicit in Not for Children. It mattered to her that her own political opinion toward pornography was strongly voiced in the title. Her political opinion being that she feared censorship more than she disliked pornography, which she disliked a great deal. As for protecting children from pornography, that was everyone's responsibility. It was a matter of common sense, not censorship, to protect children from everything that was unsuitable for them, including, Ruth had said in several interviews, any novel by Ruth Cole. Ruth basically hated arguing with men. It reminded her of arguing with her father. If she let her father win, he had a puerile way of reminding her that he'd been right. But if Ruth clearly won, Ted either wouldn't admit it, or he'd be petulant. "You always order the arugula," Alan said to her now. "I like arugula," Ruth told him. "It's not always available." To Eddie, they sounded as if they'd been married for years. Eddie wanted to talk to Ruth about Marion, but he would have to wait. When he excused himself from the table to go to the men's room, when he didn't really need to go, he'd hoped that Ruth would take this as an opportunity to visit the women's. They could at least have had a few words together, if only in a corridor. But Ruth had stayed at the table.
"My God," Alan said when Eddie was gone. "Why was O'Hare the introducer?"
"I thought he was fine," Ruth lied.
Carl explained that he and Melissa often asked Eddie O'Hare to be the introducer because he was reliable, Carl had said, and he'd never refused to introduce anybody, Melissa had added. Ruth smiled to hear this about Eddie, but Alan said, "My God, reliable? He was late. He looked like he'd been run over by a bus."
He had gone on a little too long, Carl and Melissa agreed. They'd never heard him go on too long before.
"But why did you want him to introduce you?" Alan asked Ruth. "You told me you liked the idea."
In fact, Eddie had been her idea.
Who was it who said that there was no better company for an especially personal revelation than the company of virtual strangers? Ruth herself had written that in The Same Orphanage.
Well,
Ruth was aware that Carl and Melissa were the virtual strangers in this case.
"Eddie O'Hare was my mother's lover," she announced. "It was when he was 16 and my mother was 39. I haven't seen him since I was 4, but I've always wanted to see him again, as you might imagine." She waited. No one said a word. Ruth knew how hurt Alan would be that she'd not told him before, and that when she'd finally told him, it was in front of Carl and Melissa.
"May I ask," Alan began, formally for him, "if the older woman in all of O'Hare's novels is your mother?"
"No, not according to my father," Ruth replied. "But I believe that Eddie truly loved my mother, and that his love for her as an older woman is in all of his novels."
"I see," Alan said. He'd already picked some of Ruth's arugula off her salad plate with his fingers. For a gentleman, which he was, and a lifelong New Yorker, a sophisticated man, Alan's table manners were atrocious. He ate off everybody's plate. He was not above expressing his dislike of your food after he'd eaten it, either. And food had a way of getting caught between his teeth. Ruth glanced at him now, expecting to see a telltale flag of arugula in the vicinity of one of his overlong canines. He had a long nose and a long chin, too, but they conveyed a remote elegance, which was offset by a broad, flat forehead and a closely cropped head of dark brown hair. At 54, Alan Albright showed no signs of baldness. He had not a single gray hair, either. He was almost handsome, except for his long teeth, which lent him a lupine appearance. And although he was quite lean and fit, he ate with gusto. He occasionally drank with a little too much gusto, Ruth worried, assessing him. Now, always, it seemed, she was assessing him, and too often unkindly. "I should sleep with him and make up my mind," she thought. Then Ruth remembered that Hannah Grant had stood her up. Ruth had intended to use Hannah as her excuse for not sleeping with Alan. That is, Hannah would be Ruth's excuse this time. She was going to tell Alan that she and Hannah were such old friends that they always stayed up all night and talked and talked. When Ruth's publisher wasn't paying for her accommodations in New York, Ruth usually stayed with Hannah. Ruth even had her own set of keys to Hannah's apartment. Now, without Hannah's presence, Alan would suggest that Ruth come back to his apartment, or he would ask to see her suite at the Stanhope, which Random House had provided for her. Alan had been very patient with her reluctance to sleep with him. He'd even construed her reluctance to mean that she was taking his affection for her with the utmost seriousness, which she was. It just hadn't occurred to Alan that Ruth was reluctant because she thought she might hate sleeping with him. It had something to do with his habit of taking food off other people's plates and the haste with which he ate. It wasn't because of his reputation as a former ladies' man. He'd told her frankly that the right woman, which she apparently was, had changed all that. She had no reason not to believe him. It wasn't his age, either. He was in better shape than many younger men. He didn't look 54, and he was intellectually stimulating. They had once stayed up all night, much more recently than Ruth and Hannah had stayed up all night.
reading their favorite passages of Graham Greene to each other. Alan's first present to Ruth had been Volume 1 of the Norman Sherry biography of Graham Greene. Ruth had been reading it with a deliberate slowness, both savoring it and afraid of what she might learn about Greene that she wouldn't like. It disturbed her to read biographies of writers she loved. She preferred not to know anything unlovable about them. Thus far, the Sherry biography had treated Greene with the honor Ruth thought Greene deserved. But Alan was more impatient with her for reading Norman Sherry slowly than he was impatient with her for her sexual reticence. Alan had observed that Norman Sherry was sure to publish the second volume of The Life of Graham Greene before Ruth finished reading the first. Now, with Hannah not present, Ruth realized that she could use Eddie O'Hare as her reason for not sleeping with Alan tonight. Before Eddie returned from the men's room, Ruth said, "After dinner, I hope none of you will mind. I want to have Eddie all to myself." Carl and Melissa waited for Alan to respond, but Ruth pressed ahead. "I can't imagine what my mother saw in him," Ruth said, "except that at 16, I'm sure he must have been awfully pretty." "O'Hare is still awfully pretty," Alan growled. Ruth thought, "Oh, God, don't tell me he's going to be jealous." Ruth said, "My mother may not have cared for him as much as he cared for her. Even my father can't read Eddie O'Hare's books without failing to comment that Eddie must have worshipped my mother." "Ad nauseam," said Alan Albright, who couldn't read a book by Eddie O'Hare without failing to make comments of that kind. "Please don't be jealous, Alan," Ruth said. It was her reading aloud voice, her inimitable deadpan, which they all knew. Alan looked stung. Ruth hated herself. In one evening, she'd said "fuck you" to her grandmother and to the old lady's grandchildren, and now she'd wounded the only man she'd ever considered marrying. "Anyway," Ruth told them at the table, "a chance to be alone with Eddie O'Hare is exciting for me." Poor Carl and Melissa, Ruth thought. But they were used to writers and had doubtless been exposed to more inappropriate behavior than hers. "Your mother clearly didn't leave your father for O'Hare," Alan said. He spoke more carefully than he usually did. He was trying to behave himself. He was a good man. Ruth saw that she'd made him afraid of her temper, for which she hated herself anew. "That must be true," Ruth replied with equal care. "But any woman would have had just cause to leave my father." "Your mother left you, too," Alan interjected. Of course, they had talked and talked about that. "That's also true," Ruth replied. "That's precisely what I want to talk to Eddie about. I've heard what my father has to say about my mother, but my father doesn't love her. I want to hear what someone who loves her has to say about that." "You think O'Hare still loves your mother?" Alan asked. "You've read his books," Ruth answered. "Ad nauseam," Alan said again. "He's an awful snob," Ruth thought. But she liked snobs. Then Eddie came back to the table. "We've been talking about you, O'Hare," Alan said in a cavalier fashion. Eddie looked nervous.
"I told them about you and Mother," Ruth said to Eddie.
Eddie tried to look composed, although the wet wool of his jacket clung to him like a shroud. In the candlelight, he saw the bright yellow hexagon shining in the iris of Ruth's right eye. When the light flickered, or when she turned her face toward the light, her eye changed color from brown to amber in the same way that the same hexagon of yellow could turn Marion's right eye from blue to green. "I love your mother," Eddie began, without embarrassment. He'd needed only to think of Marion, and he had once regained his composure, which he'd lost on the squash court while losing 3 games to Jimmy. Eddie's composure had not seemed to him recoverable until now. Alan looked astonished when Eddie asked the waiter for some ketchup and a paper napkin. It was not the kind of restaurant where ketchup was served, nor was there a paper napkin in the place. Alan took charge. It was one of his likable qualities. He went out on Second Avenue and quickly located a cheaper sort of restaurant. He was back at the table in 5 minutes with a half dozen paper napkins and a ketchup bottle that was less than a quarter full.
"I hope it's enough," he said.
He'd paid $5 for the nearly empty ketchup bottle.
"It's plenty for my purposes," Eddie told him.
"Thank you, Alan," Ruth said warmly. Gallantly, he blew her a kiss. Eddie poured a spreading puddle of the ketchup on his butter plate. The waiter looked on with grave distaste.
"Stick your right index finger in the ketchup," Eddie said to Ruth.
"My finger?" Ruth asked him.
"Please," Eddie said to her. "I just want to see how much you remember."
"How much I remember," Ruth said. She dabbed her finger in the ketchup, wrinkling her nose like a child.
"Now touch the napkin," Eddie told her, sliding the paper napkin toward her. Ruth hesitated, but Eddie took her hand and gently pressed her right index finger on the napkin. Ruth licked the rest of the ketchup off her finger while Eddie positioned the napkin exactly where he wanted it. On the far side of Ruth's water glass, so that the glass magnified the fingerprint. And there it was, as it would be, forever. The perfectly vertical line on her right index finger. Seen through the water glass, it was nearly twice the size of the scar itself.
"Do you remember?" Eddie asked her. The yellow hexagon in Ruth's right eye was dulled with tears. She couldn't speak.
"Nobody else will ever have a fingerprint like yours," Eddie told her, as he'd told her on the day her mother left.
"And my scar will always be there?"
Ruth asked him, as she had asked him 32 years ago, when she was 4.
"Your scar will be part of you forever," Eddie promised her, as he had promised her then.
"Yes," Ruth whispered.
"I remember. I remember almost everything," she told him through her tears.
Later, alone in her suite at the Stanhope, Ruth remembered that Eddie had held her hand while she cried. She also recalled how wonderfully understanding Alan had been. Without a word, which was so uncharacteristic of him, Alan had ushered Carl and Melissa, and most remarkably himself, to another table in the restaurant. And Alan had insisted to the maitre d' that it be a faraway table, not within hearing distance of Ruth and Eddie. Ruth was unaware of when Alan and Carl and Melissa had left the restaurant. Finally, while she and Eddie were debating the subject of which of them would pay for their dinner, Ruth had drunk an entire bottle of wine, and Eddie didn't drink. The waiter had interrupted their debate by telling them that Alan had already paid for everything. Now, in the bedroom of her hotel, Ruth considered calling Alan and thanking him, but he would probably be asleep. It was almost 1 a.m., and she had been so stimulated to talk and to listen to Eddie that she didn't want to feel let down, as she might if she talked to Alan. Alan's sensitivity had impressed her, but the subject of her mother, which Eddie had instantly taken up, was too much on her mind. Although she hardly needed more to drink, Ruth opened one of those lethal little bottles of cognac that universally lurk in minibars. She lay in her bed, sipping the strong drink and wondering what to write in her diary. There was so much she wanted to say. Most of all, Eddie had assured her that her mother had loved her. One might write a whole book about that. Ruth's father had tried to reassure her of that for 32 years, but her father, given his cynicism about her mother, had failed to convince her. Naturally, Ruth had heard the theory of how her dead brothers had robbed her mother of her capacity to love another child. There was also the theory that Marion had been afraid to love Ruth, out of fear of losing her only daughter to some calamity of the kind that had claimed her sons. But Eddie had told Ruth the story of the moment when Marion recognized that Ruth had a flawed eye, that hexagon of bright yellow which her mother also had in her eye. Eddie told Ruth how Marion had cried in fear, for this yellow flaw meant to her that Ruth might be like her, and her mother hadn't wanted Ruth to be like her.
For Ruth, there was suddenly more love in her mother, for not wishing anything of herself on her daughter, than Ruth could bear. Ruth and Eddie had talked about whether Ruth was more like her mother or her father. The more he listened to Ruth, the more Eddie saw of Marion in her. The subject mattered greatly to Ruth because she didn't want to be a mother if she was going to be a bad one.
"That's just what your mother said," Eddie told her.
"But what worse thing could a mother do than leave her child?" Ruth had asked him. "That's what your father says, isn't it?" Eddie asked her. Her father was a sexual predator, Ruth told Eddie, but he'd been halfway decent as a father. He'd never neglected her. It was as a woman that she loathed him. As a child, she had doted on him. At least he was there.
"He would have been a terrible influence on those boys had they lived," Eddie told her. Ruth instantly agreed. "That's why your mother had already thought of leaving him. I mean, before the boys were killed," Eddie added. Ruth hadn't known that. She expressed considerable bitterness toward her father for withholding that information from her, but Eddie explained that Ted couldn't have told her because Ted hadn't known that Marion might leave him.
Ruth and Eddie had talked about so much that Ruth couldn't begin to describe it in her diary. Eddie had even called Marion the sexual beginning and the sexual peak of his life. Ruth did manage to write that down. And in the taxi ride to the Stanhope, with that awful old woman's shopping bag of books between his knees, Eddie had said to Ruth, "That awful old woman, as you call her, is about your mother's age. Therefore, she's not an awful old woman to me." It was staggering to Ruth that a 48-year-old man was still carrying a torch for a woman who was now 71. "Supposing that my mother lives into her 90s, will you be a love-struck 68-year-old?" Ruth had asked Eddie.
"I'm absolutely certain of it," Eddie had told her.
What Ruth Cole also wrote in her diary was that Eddie O'Hare was the antithesis of her father. At 77, Ted Cole was still chasing women who were Ruth's age, although he was less and less successful at it. His more common successes were with women in their late 40s, women who were Eddie's age. If Ruth's father lived into his 90s, he might finally be pursuing women who at least looked closer to his age, namely women who were merely in their 70s. Then the phone rang. Ruth couldn't help being disappointed that it was Alan. She'd picked up the phone with the hope that it might be Eddie. "Maybe he's remembered something else to tell me," Ruth had wished.
"Not asleep, I hope," Alan said. "And you're alone, I trust."
"Not asleep. Definitely alone," Ruth answered him. Why did he have to spoil what a favorable impression he'd made by sounding the jealousy note?
"How did it go?" Alan asked her.
She felt suddenly too tired to tell him the details, which, only moments before he called, had so excited her.
"It was a very special evening," Ruth said. "It's given me so much more of a picture of my mother, actually both of her and of myself," she added. "Maybe I shouldn't be afraid that I'd be a rotten wife. Maybe I wouldn't make a bad mother."
"I've told you that," Alan reminded her.
Why couldn't he just be grateful that she was possibly coming around to the idea of what he wanted? That was when Ruth knew that she would not have sex with Alan the next night either. What sense did it make to sleep with someone and then go off to Europe for almost three weeks? As much sense as it made to keep putting off sleeping with him, Ruth reconsidered. She wouldn't agree to marry Alan without sleeping with him first, at least once.
"Alan, I'm awfully tired, and there's too much that's too new on my mind," Ruth began.
"I'm listening," he said.
"I don't want to have dinner with you tomorrow night. I don't want to see you until I'm back from Europe," she told him. She half hoped that he would try to dissuade her, but he was silent. Even his patience with her was irritating.
I'm still listening, he said, because she had paused.
I want to sleep with you. I must sleep with you, Ruth assured him. But not just before I go away, and not just before I see my father, Ruth added, which she knew was apropos of nothing. I want the time away to think about us. That was finally how she put it.
I understand, Alan said.
It broke her heart to know he was a good man, but not to know if he was the right one. And how would time away help her to determine that, Ruth wondered. What she needed in order to know was more time with Alan. But what she said was, I knew you'd understand.
I love you very much, Alan told her.
I know you do, Ruth said. Later, as she struggled to fall asleep, she tried not to think of her father. Although Ted Cole had told his daughter about her mother's affair with Eddie O'Hare, Ted had neglected to tell Ruth that their affair had been his idea. When Eddie had told her that her father had purposely brought him and Marion together, Ruth had been shocked. That her father had connived to make her mother feel that she was unfit to be a mother was not what shocked Ruth. She already knew that her father was a conniver. What shocked Ruth was that her father had wanted her all to himself, that he'd wanted to be her father so badly. At 36, both loving and hating her father as she now did, it tormented Ruth to know how much her father loved her.